From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Will live Earth be good for the planet? Hello again, I'm Orin Almy, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Live Earth produced 9 concerts featuring world-class pop stars along with local acts on 7 continents, plus Al Gore on the Washington Mall. There were 24 hours of music, commercials for ecological products, and political exhortations. On To the Point, was it a high point of the Green Revolution or just another high-tech spectacle? Will millions of people change their lifestyles? Will they force governments and corporations to act on the message? Or will the massive audience be lulled into feeling better without insisting on the changes that could make a difference? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the latest thing in air travel, a plastic plane. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Live Earth was seen and heard around the world for 24 hours this weekend with 9 concerts on 7 continents. On To the Point, will it advance Al Gore's hopes for a green revolution or allow a massive audience to feel better without the corporate, governmental, and personal changes that could make a global difference? On Reporter's Notebook, Boeing's new Dreamliner is taking the airline industry by storm before its first flight. First, this news update. Defense Secretary Robert Gates has canceled a trip to South America amid reports that he's part of an agonizing reappraisal of Iraq strategy at the Bush White House, set off in part by defections of high-ranking Republican senators. Press Secretary Tony Snow was grilled by reporters today.
Putting aside a timetable, is there a debate for right now going on inside the White House for a gradual withdrawal of U.S. troops, as the New York Times said, a gradual withdrawal?
No, there's no plan. Again, ultimately, the president wants to withdraw troops based on the facts on the ground, not on the matter of politics.
Howard LaFranchi is diplomatic correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Howard, thanks very much for joining us.
Good to talk to you, Warren.
You've written a story very much like the one in the New York Times, talking about a post-surge Iraq strategy. What would it look like?
Well, first of all, I think it's important. You had the quote from Tony Snow, but I'd like to point out that there was another quote from Mr. Snow this morning. He said there is no debate right now on withdrawing troops right now from Iraq. He repeated that right now twice, and no one is saying that there is a debate on withdrawing troops right now. The debate is, as you say, on the post-surge strategy. And what the discussion is entails is drawing down troops, refocusing them from sorting out the fight among Iraqis to focusing on fighting Islamist extremists, primarily those associated with Al-Qaeda, and on retraining Iraqi or training Iraqi troops to take on the fight themselves and perhaps protecting the borders. It's a plan that in many ways looks very much like the recommendations that the Iraq Study Group came out with last year.
Again, we're talking with Howard LaFranchi at the Christian Science Monitor. When you say post-surge, what are we talking about? Are we talking about post-September? There's also another report that's about to come out to the Congress from the administration due this week.
Yes, well, that question of when the post-surge strategy would kick in, that's really the crux of things, because the reason this is coming up now is, as you mentioned, the defection among Republicans, but the administration thought they would have at least until September and perhaps even through the end of the year to decide what that post-surge strategy was going to be. But the timetable, if I can use that word, the timetable has been pushed up by primarily by the very high number of deaths of U.S. Soldiers, some of the worst months of the war, in fact, since the surge policy kicked in. And so we have these senators who are saying, well, the Iraqis aren't doing what they were supposed to do the Iraqi government is not doing what it was supposed to do as its part of the bargain, and so we can't keep sacrificing our troops. And so this timetable or a the push for a post-surge strategy has been pushed up by these events.
Over the weekend, the deadliest blast since the war began in Iraq, enormous number of Iraqis killed, and since the 1st of July, a very large number of American soldiers have died as well. You were in Iraq a month or so ago. What did you find in the way of morale?
I guess I would answer that two ways. First of all, and I'm assuming you're talking among U.S. troops.
Indeed.
I have been to Iraq a number of times. I found much more willingness to on the part of soldiers to question being in Iraq. There's still a very high degree of dedication to cause a purpose that the sentiment of we were sent here to do a job and that's what we're trying to do. And a feeling that they are also in their areas doing good things for the Iraqi people, but like everyone else, frustration with the Iraqi government. Now, among the Iraqi people, I found much more despair than I had ever felt before, and there too a level of frustration with the government, but just in general, and a lot of that despair coming back against the United States.
Okay, so a very difficult situation facing the White House with a tough week coming up. I guess they are hoping to keep things relatively calm until the Congress adjourns during August. We will see, of course, what happens in the next 3 or 4 weeks. Howard LaFranchi, as always, very good to have you on our program.
Well, thanks so much.
Diplomatic correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. In a moment, will live Earth be good for the planet? On To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Elney back with To The Point. Live Earth was a 24-hour concert at 9 venues on 7 continents, featuring a galaxy of world-class pop stars along with local acts aimed at reaching across the planet. In the words of Al Gore, the creator and organizer, Live Earth was designed to trigger a global movement to stop the climate crisis. One of the groups at London's Wembley Stadium was Spinal Tap from the 1984 mock rock concert film This Is Spinal Tap. We're hoping to have one of the performers from Spinal Tap on our program in just a moment. First, let me introduce George Marshall. He's founder of the Climate Outreach Information Network. That's a nonprofit that educates the public about global warming. He's publisher of the blog ClimateDenial.org. George Marshall, welcome to our program.
Pleasure to be on it.
What's your take? You were skeptical before the concert took place. How do you feel now, having watched it?
Well, you know, it's very hard when you're in, when many of your colleagues are strongly supporting something to stand outside it and be critical. But I have to say, having seen the thing, I feel utterly vindicated. I think it's really a lost opportunity. We're all on the same side. We're all struggling with the same basic problem, which is that, you know, people are not making the connection between what we know about climate change and what we do. But given that the objective of this, the stated objective, was to kick off a movement, it failed to do any of the things which I would think would start off a movement. And it fell into a lot of very very easy and obvious traps. It really gave people the impression that very, very small measures were not just first steps, but were actually in themselves enough to deal with climate change. So we had, like, Joss Stone was out there, for example, and she did this very sort of like little patronizing spiel about, well, it's not asking too much. You plant a tree, you dig a hole, and you just drop it in. That's all you do. Well, it isn't all you do. You know, we need, as Al Gore's program was saying, you know, what this is meant to be pushing for is very major cuts. But also, I was very concerned that the whole way through, people giving the impression that the actual concerts themselves and the act of being at the concert and participating was in itself an action on climate change. As if what we needed to do was have masses of people putting pressure on the government. And in a way, we do need that. But this is an unusual issue in that actually, certainly here in Europe, we actually have quite a lot of political momentum. What we need is for people to understand how big this issue is and to really to grasp the vision of the society we need to move towards.
Okay, George Marshall, once again, founder of the Climate Outreach Information Network. As I said, one of the groups performing at London's Wembley Stadium was Spinal Tap from the 1984 rock concert film. Harry Shearer once again hosts Le Show on public radio. He plays 21 characters on The Simpsons. He is Spinal Tap's bass player, Derek Smalls. I should also add he is a very sophisticated political analyst. Harry Shearer, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Warren. Sorry I dropped off, but I'm on a cell phone in London.
Glad to have you back. Give us your perspective as a live Earth performer and respond, if you will, to what we just heard from George Marshall.
Well, you know, I mean, let's face it, the last one of these that occurred was given the manifesto to make poverty history, and we know how well that's worked out. So these are always chancy, large, grand objectives that are set for what are basically entertainment spectacles. I think, you know, as with that one, the best, perhaps, that you can hope for this one is a slight nudging of the public opinion needle. These are, after all, musicians. They're not educators. They're not community leaders. They're people who for, and let's recognize it, for mixed reasons, which are the probably safe to say the motivations that most people do everything good or bad in their lives come together to participate in this consciousness-raising event.
So you think then it's too much to say that it's going to kick off a global movement?
I think that's a little, shall we say, optimistic. It, you know, at best, I think that...
We are having problems with Harry Shearer's cell phone. Once again, he dropped out a bit ago, as he indicated. He's on a cell phone in London. We may not be able to get him back as our program proceeds. But we heard what he had to say, which George Marshall was not all that different from what you said. On the other hand, he thought that at least a slight nudging of public opinion would accomplish. What's wrong with it? Would be accomplished. What's wrong with that?
Great. Let's nudge public opinion. You know, whenever I think, what are all of the things we can do on climate change, someone has an idea, say, great, just do it. We need everything happening. And of course, we need all of the world entertainment industry backing it as well. I guess really the concern with this is that it was a lost opportunity because it could have been so, so much more. I mean, I guess really compared actually maybe what Harry was saying, I think it could have done, I think you can expect more of these kinds of events and that they could achieve more. I think that he was touching on it a little bit when he was saying, you know, these are entertainers, not educators. And I think a huge mistake made by this was not in any shape or form bringing the entertainers together behind the combined vision that Al Gore was promoting around the events. So in all of the interviews and all of the statements they were making on stage, it was clear that, first of all, they hadn't really got any idea of the basic issue that they were there about and had a very superficial and, in some cases, completely wrong understanding of it. But they weren't actually pushing together for the objectives of a concert. So I think there was a major organizational failure in the concert to actually really get the people on message. It's like if something is about communicating and about nudging public opinion, it's a very good idea to have everyone pushing in the same direction rather than all over the place and saying whatever they want to say.
George Marshall, again, with Climate Outreach Information Network. Martin Lewis is a humorist. He's a commentator, writes about politics and pop culture for the Huffington Post. He's also one of the pioneers of rock benefits, starting with The Secret Policeman's Ball, a series of benefit shows that he co-produced for Amnesty International some years ago. Martin Lewis, good to have you on our program.
Very pleased to be here.
What do you say to what we heard from George Marshall, that the entertainers weren't on message, that that was a lost opportunity?
Have you ever tried to get any rock musician to be on message about anything? It's completely impossible. I think there's a little bit of not so much naivete as wishful thinking there. There is a bigger picture here, and that is that you cannot expect rock stars to be perfectly on message. That's not their skill. Their skill is to draw general attention to an issue. And I believe that this was an overwhelming success. Yes, you can nitpick and say, in an ideal world, these performers would have had a more precise message and they would have conveyed it. But I'm concerned, and from my personal experience, I know that these things are not accomplished overnight. I think it's perhaps we live in an instant society where we want instant gratification. We want to wave a magic wand. We want to have an event that suddenly educates people generally. But I know that from working with Amnesty International, back in 1976, John Cleese and I put together the first of what became the Secret Policeman's Ball shows. At that time, in England, I have to tell you that Amnesty International was a very small intelligentsia organization written about in small print in the quality papers. The tabloids had never heard of us. The regular, ordinary folks had not, and certainly young kids had never heard. But by using entertainers, first the Monty Pythons, and subsequently a lot of rock performers, including folks such as Sting and Bono, we used Peter Gabriel, we used Eric Clapton, Pete Townsend. These performers, over a period of time, and that's where I stress, the human rights issue went from registering practically zero on the meter to becoming a concern to young people in a big way. And that, of course, we haven't solved the human rights issue in the world, but the awareness and the attitudes towards it have changed considerably over the last 31 years. So it's a dreadful shame that it's taken so long since the founding of Earth Day to get to this point. However, I'm always preferring to see a half full glass than a half empty glass, a recyclable glass, I should say.
Martin Lewis, a veteran of the forum that we're talking about. We do have Harry Shearer back again on his cell phone in London. He only has a few minutes with us. But, Harry, I wanted to ask you this with regard to the attitudes, degree of information on the part of the performers. A lot of them are said to be buying carbon credits in order to compensate for the jet fuel that they used up flying around the world to go to these venues and so on. Did you see many of them doing that? Are you doing that?
Well, I don't think you saw people doing that. I haven't been given a way to do that myself. I mean, they haven't given us information on it, although they did give us backstage a fairly large loose leaf binder with sort of the background information on the whole event, and I didn't read it, and I doubt that very many of the performers did. So maybe that was the reason that people weren't as on message as one might have desired. I think, you know, the greater danger, obviously most of these performers were going to be taking planes anyway. This is the time when they're touring, and this was a stop-off on most of their tours, Spinal Tap being a radical exception because they were brought back basically from the near dead. But I think, you know, the greater danger in a way is that rock stars being earnest always opens itself up to a bit of ridicule. You know, the movies that I'm involved with Christopher Guest, earnestness is sort of our primary target. So you take that chance if you're talking about this, and our approach was sort of to do it with a bit more humor than I think most of the other people there. But that's the target anyway, is you know, or that's the danger anyway, is that people are just going to be seen as a bit risible because of their earnestness, and you take that risk if you think it's worth it.
Did you change your act, you of Spinal Tap, in any significant way in order to be on message?
We wrote a song for the occasion called Warmer Than Hell, which the premise of which was that the devil, because Spinal Tap is very into sort of channeling the thoughts of the devil. And so the devil came to Britain expecting it to be cold and rainy, and each community he went to, it was hot, and he was ticked off about that.
Okay.
So that was...
Okay. So you feel then, on balance, that it was a small nudge forward. Was it worth it?
Was it worth it? I think we'll see, you know, the great accounting will be held down the line a little way. It was certainly worth it for us because it was an amazing event to be part of. And when, you know, let me be honest, a friend of mine who was attending the event in the audience section said, certainly speaking about the people who were surrounding her, the main intention, the main motivation of most of the people she saw at the event itself was to, as she put it, well, I won't use her words, but to get drunk on beer as quickly as possible. So the question is, was the television event really effective? And I think we'll see that down the line in what people say to their political leaders, you know, for weeks and months ahead.
Harry Shearer, as always, thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure, Warren. Thanks.
With Spinal Tap at the concert, also with the Simpsons and Le Show on public radio. George Marshall, back to you with climate outrage information. What about what DeMartin Lewis told us a moment ago about what happened with the secret policeman's balls and the fact that Amnesty International went from being barely unknown to having a real impact on governments and on public opinion with worldwide?
Those events had very clear objectives, and they met those objectives many times over. The the goal was to promote amnesty, and in that sense, indeed, I mean, I was a teenager in Britain at the time those were happening, and they had a very big impact. Amnesty suddenly we became aware of. I think you can judge the effectiveness of things by their objectives and how far they meet them. I should add also on that point, you know, Eric Clapton, Sting, Pete Townsend, these are not people who are off message. These are people who certainly knew the issues behind human rights well and were actually good spokespeople for the cause, and we were clearly well briefed up, and I've seen them all speak on these topics. So I think the problem with this is that I still go back to that point that people are not clearly on message, but I also think this wasn't clearly enough about promoting an organization, or, you know, there's a lot of very, very important goals behind it, and the things that Al Gore's been holding up to say, this is what we're aiming for. I'm behind those 100%. I think they're extremely important. But it's not clear to me that what's going to come out of this is going to be, for example, strengthening for the organizations that are already working on it. There's some kind of vague pledge thing, like, you know, sign this pledge. But I didn't hear it being promoted very strongly in the concerts. That's crucial, because that is the point where the organizations are going to really make the political headway, just as Amnesty did back in the sort of 70s and 80s, and now there's a whole range of environmental organizations going to move forward with that. That's what they have to work with. So I'd say to anyone who's listening to this program, go and sign that pledge, because it's not the pledge which is important. It's the fact that you're passing your contact over to the people who are going to do something with it and make political use out of it.
Do you think that people already are aware of the problem of climate change, and is it sort of redundant in that sense?
I know in the States it's lower than here in Europe, but certainly it's clear that the majority in the States, and here in Britain in recent polls, 85% of people are saying that climate change is a problem. However, you have to qualify that and say what do people think of climate change. And when, as soon as you start going into the opinion, what you tend to find is that people regard climate change as being something which is going to affect other people in the future. They don't regard it as a local issue, and they don't regard it as something now. So I think there's quite a lot of denial surrounding climate change, but people are doing everything they can to push it away, to say, okay, small measures will make the difference. You know, we only have to do a few things right now. It's going to be a problem in the future. We don't have to worry about it. But like smokers, I've been a smoker for many years. I'm not now. And it's always like, oh, yeah, there's that cancer thing, but it's going to be something, you know, when I'm 60, I don't have to think about it now. So I think the challenge of any kind of communication is not to tell people climate change is there and it's a problem, to say it's a problem now. And the things we're going to have to do are exciting, too. It's like that was another lost opportunity. You know, rock music can be very, very exciting. The whole youth culture can be very exciting. It should be building an excitement about the potential of where we can go to, rather than, again, messing around with stuff and turning the lights out.
George Marshall, again, with Climate Outreach Information Network. We're going to come back and continue this conversation in a moment on Reporter's Notebook. At the time, the airline industry is taking heat for its impact on the environment, Boeing introduces a plastic plane. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the Live Earth concert, 24 hours of music and other events taking place at 9 venues on 7 continents worldwide. Al Gore, the principal sponsor, he being on the Washington Mall. Matt Peterson is president of the environmental organization Global Green. He works regularly with celebrities. They hold an annual Green pre-Oscars party, where stars arrive early in energy-saving cars and in other ways show their commitment to trying to change their habits. Matt Peterson, good to have you with us.
Good to talk to you, Warren.
What's your take on the issues that we have been discussing here? Do you think that this was something that will, in fact, increase global awareness, or is it a lost opportunity, as was said by George Marshall?
Well, there's no doubt that awareness about global warming and some of the solutions have increased because of live Earth. I mean, we're in such a state of the need of for the urgent action on behalf of our governments and corporations in particular that we need to pursue every avenue. So whether it's live Earth or, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio's upcoming movie, The 11th Hour, or the work our organization's doing in New Orleans to rebuild homes green with Brad Pitt, we need to pursue every avenue possible.
What about the concern raised earlier that it's possible for the audience under these circumstances to confuse attending a concert, having a good time, feeling good about your intentions, to confuse that with action?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we don't want to oversimplify the issue. At the same time, we need to communicate in a very simple way so people understand the challenge and what they can do about it. So is this the answer? No. Is it part of the answer? Yes. And we need to continue the drumbeat. And now we need to follow up with what are the concrete steps that individuals can take to call on their government and corporate leaders? I mean, we need corporate leaders and our politicians to be held accountable for the inaction that's going on in Washington and fighting of legislation in other places.
What about that pledge then? Was it too vague to really mean anything?
Well, the pledge had many good things embedded in it. We need to embark on the next step beyond the Kyoto Protocol by 2009. That's a good date to start by because right now, we're waiting till 2012 in the official process. 2009 is probably the right date to start. So it had good things in there. I think a little of it got lost, of course, in the shuffle as the attention became about, you know, what Madonna was doing or what she didn't do to, you know, appropriately participate. But I think that's part of the challenge anytime. If you live by the sword, you die by the sword. So if the celebrities draw attention, you know, you also get the downside that come with working with them, and you need to be prepared for that. And I think Live Earth did a good job in pulling off a logistical nightmare, which was pulling off 9 shows in 7 different continents and really reaching out to the global public as well as the American public.
You mentioned Madonna. We heard earlier about some of the rock stars that were early on in the human rights movement who were very well versed in that area and even composed songs about it. Does it matter which celebrities you choose for these kinds of events?
Well, I think overall it does. I mean, I think to have a spokesperson who really, to be as authentic as possible, I think it does. For something like Live Earth, I don't think it matters as much. I don't think anybody expects to go to a concert of or to watch it on TV of this magnitude and expect everyone to be an expert or as well-versed as, say, Leonardo DiCaprio or Ed Begley is about global warming. So I don't think it mattered so much for this concert. I mean, certainly some of the questions about the credibility of Madonna, those are legitimate, but they're a red herring in the end. What we needed to focus on was all these people gave their time and traveled the distance, yes, and offset their carbon, whether they did it or the concert organizers did it. That's part of it. That's a good thing. But we needed to recognize that this is an amazing come together of people around the globe. And is it going to solve global warming? No. But is it going to help move the needle a little bit in public opinion and getting corporate leaders and government leaders to pay attention? Yes.
Do you think that the audience assumes that simply by their presence, all of the participants are on message?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm sure there were plenty of people that went to the show that tuned out Melissa Etheridge when she gave her great poetry statement, or however you would describe it, during her performance, because they just came to have a good time and listen to great music. But I think there were enough people that were both watching in the audience and on television that knew that this was an important event to show that it was time to get off our rear ends and begin to act. And did it solve? You know, again, I don't think any of them believe the performers are perfect. May add to some cynicism out there, but it is an important step forward.
Matt Peterson with Global Green. Jody Freeman is a professor of law, director of the Environmental Law Program at Harvard Law School. She's been involved in major suits, including some at the U.S. Supreme Court on this issue. And Jody Freeman, good to have you on our program.
Pleasure to be with you.
What is your take on this event? Do you think that it is ultimately the kind of thing that's going to get enough people involved in this issue to fundamentally make a difference.
Well, you know, it's hard to be against something like this at the level of education, consciousness raising, putting the issue out into the public. It's all good. And it may have a very incremental, small effect. But what worries me is the implicit suggestion that small individual acts are going to really solve the climate problem. There's nothing wrong with taking individual steps to reduce energy consumption, for example. And it's nice to say that you offset your carbon emissions flying over to England. But I don't think those are really sufficient measures to address the enormity, the enormous economic, technological, and diplomatic challenge that we now face. And let me just be very specific. I think this kind of event can only really amount to change if what happens is you mobilize the energy into political action, as some of your guests were saying, which means we need government and corporate entities to start changing their behavior. In particular, we need government to lead the way. If there's any problem that requires a concerted effort by government, not only here in the United States, but around the world, especially a concerted effort by the developing nations, China and India, that are going to be soon going to be massive contributors of GHGs, if there was ever a problem that needed government action, it's climate change. So the individual level at which the concerts appeal to people, I think, is somewhat misleading.
On the other hand, when you talk about the enormity of the challenge, whether it comes from government leadership or from corporations, certainly it's going to need an enormous amount of public support, because we're talking, are we not, about real and important changes in people's lifestyles.
Yes, it's true, and the public support is always going to be the thing that will drive politicians to act. You see, for example, in California, Arnold Schwarzenegger is motivated, first of all, because he's in a very blue state on environmental issues, and he needed to respond to that, and he became a leader on the climate change issue, and there's political support for that. And you see that now happening more and more in the states, some individual states in the U.S. There's certainly less political support for this in the United States than in Europe, and so we badly need to educate the electorate and sort of help people to learn that they ought to be demanding action from their politicians and from their corporate leaders. I have to say, if I were 20 years old going to one of these concerts, I'd be mad. I'd be mad that, you know, my generation was going to inherit these problems and was going to, after all, you know, it's the younger generation that's going to have to make the hard decisions to really address the climate problem and deal with all of the economic costs and the political instability that it could cause. And yet I don't see anger out there. I don't understand why that generation is not mad at what it is we're delivering to them.
Professor Jody Freeman at Harvard Law School, you mentioned Arnold Schwarzenegger, his effort in the blue state of California. He's just gotten into a lot of trouble because the Air Resources Board, which is probably the major agency in the country that's really been dealing with this issue, had two people resign claiming that his staff was, in fact, causing them on a the subterranean level to slow down rather than to speed up in areas that would clean the air and deal with global warming.
Well, there has been a real problem here. There are several accounts of this. One is that the governor, the staff, was interfering with the board and trying to get them to slow down. There's another account that says the governor was upset with Bob Sawyer, the chair of the board, because, in fact, he took action to be more lenient on air pollution compliance, and that sent the wrong message to Washington that we were going to ease up on deadlines here in California, when the governor is at the same time trying to force the Environmental Protection Agency to grant a waiver to California to go ahead and regulate tailpipe emissions. So that account says that the governor was actually impatient with the board. I don't know what's true, except I can tell you that the solution that the governor chose, it was to appoint Mary Nichols, who has stellar environmental credentials and is a very experienced administrator. And I think Mary is going to lead the way for this agency to roll out the global warming program that the governor has really put at the top of his agenda. You're right to say that this agency, the Air Resources Board here in California, is probably the most important agency at the moment in all of the United States because it is trying to figure out a way to implement the statute that requires for in California about a 25% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2020. It's a really tough agenda, and everybody is going to be watching how this board puts together the program to accomplish that.
Once again, there are more than one version of exactly what's going on, but what it illustrates, it seems to me, is that when you really begin to talk about real solutions to the global warming process and the greenhouse gas problem, you get into a very expensive issues for a lot of different people, special interests of all kinds, not to mention the general public. Let me go back to Martin Lewis again, who's worked with all the way back to the Secret Policeman's Ball series, benefiting Amnesty International. Interested in your take on what was just said about if Jody Freeman were 20, she said she'd be mad. Why do you think there isn't more anger? Is that something that that ought to have been expressed but wasn't by the various performers in the concert?
Well, 2 points, really. I agree that it's a shame that more people aren't agitated, but that is not restricted merely to the environment. There are other issues that one would like to see young people as angry as I was in the 60s, but that just seems to be that we live in a more flippant society where it's harder to engage and get people more emotionally involved in issues that are of direct concern. I certainly remember when I was 14 or 15 or 20, I got very angry and I got very agitated and I became much more determined. That, I think, is about society. I would like first, though, to return to a point that George mentioned. I'm grateful that in his teens, which means I'm unfortunately much older than him, he remembers the Amnesty shows, but his memory may be slightly clouded. I know that when I first approached the various rock artists that I involved in the Secret Policeman's Ball, I would like to spin you a yarn and tell you that they were motivated by human rights. They weren't initially. When I first went to Pete Townsend and asked him to appear in the Secret Policeman's Ball, I lured him along on the basis that he wanted to meet John Cleese. Sting I lured along 2 years later because he wanted to emulate Pete Townsend and because he was looking for a device to give him a solo career separate from the Police. Each of these performers had other motivations initially. Now, the beauty is that a few years later, they really did become motivated. And what George remembers well, and I'm pleased he does, is that in 1986, we did the Caravan of Hope, which was a tour of the U.S., and then Jack Healey and I put together the Human Rights Now World Tour, which included Sting, Peter Gabriel, and Bruce Springsteen. And by then, Sting was an exceptionally articulate individual on the topic. He'd educate himself. Bono was unaware of Amnesty International till he saw Sting at the Secret Policeman's Ball, and he's actually gone on record saying, that planted a seed with me that then grew. And Bono's political and social awareness grew from seeing other performers. So I think in a sense, these events, if we can look at them as Johnny Appleseed events, They plant seeds. They get people aware. They do not solve everything overnight. You do not get performers who are on message or educated initially. But eventually, and, you know, I know that the planet's running out of time here, but that's not the fault of rock performers. If you can get those performers motivated and you can then get them to grab the attention, of, especially of young people, aging baby boomers like myself, other than nagging our political leaders, we can't do as much as young people. If young people start to think about it, not just at the day of the concert when they've had a good time, but they reflect on the fact that so many of the people that they admire gave up their time to do this, I think that's it's small steps, but they're important steps.
Martin Lewis, let me go back to Professor Freeman. Harry Shearer, one of the participants in the concert, said earlier that there may have been mixed motives on the part of other performers for being in the concert. He said a lot of the people who went there wanted to get drunk on beer. What do you think it would take to, or well, again, I guess the point is that we'll have to see what sort of follow-up there is by the performers as well as the audience. But Jody Freeman, if young people were to get mad and were then to start agitating for governmental change and corporate behavioral change and so on, what ought they to do?
Well, I think the most important thing is to actually register young people to vote and make sure they vote. This has been a perennial problem. You remember the Rock the Vote effort that tried to press upon the younger generation how important they could be if they voted. Most people viewed that as a pretty significant failure. And in order to make a difference here, in order to get politicians to get moving, you really need to show a swell of support in the electorate. So, you know, linking these events to voter registration, linking them to linking the people who attend them into some kind of organized movement, an organized setting in which people are actually lobbying Congress in particular. The biggest gap here in the United States is the failure at the federal level to pass a federal law. And then linking people into kind of pestering and calling at the very local level for state and local officials to take action, too. Because you need all of that. You need your states taking the lead, as they are now in the U.S. But the states alone can't really accomplish significant enough policy changes. There's going to be a need for a federal law that says we're going to cut these emissions by a certain amount over a period of time, a federal policy for research and development into technology that will help us transition to a less greenhouse gas intensive economy. And then you need a federal law, too, to make the federal government credible when it goes to negotiate an international agreement to get a more binding set of commitments globally. So you need every level of government engaged, which means you need the electorate pressing them at every jurisdictional level.
Jody Freeman, again, professor at Harvard Law School. George Marshall, back to you at the Climate Outreach Information Network. If, in fact, Al Gore and others begin to move in the direction that Professor Freeman is suggesting, would that then make this a success?
Totally. It's going to be completely a matter of as to whether all of those billions of people who are there can somehow be brought in behind, you know, some very clear and active political activism, which is, you know, which is happening, I know, in the States. It's certainly happening here. You know, there's all of the green groups and actually a number of trade unions and church groups have come together here in Britain and have a very clear political agenda. It's a matter of how far we can move that. What I think is very important, though, is that people recognize the extent of what is necessary for that. And I think that's going back again to this, you know, to this point about small steps. It's like, well, no, people have to recognize it does mean we're going to have to live very, very differently, and we're going to have to transport ourselves about very differently, and it's not going to be a matter of a few trees here and there. I completely agree, though, about this point about emotions. I mean, we should be both getting angry and upset about what's going on, and we should be getting really, really excited about the potential for how we can build actually a completely amazing new world on the back of this problem. And as I said, I don't see enough of this emotion generally. I just see slick messages and slogans. But I don't see the kind of like power and energy that is yet necessary to build the kind of movement we need on it.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it at that. George Marshall with the Climate Outreach Information Network, thanks to you. Thanks to Martin Lewis, a veteran of Secret Policeman's Ball and other concerts of this type. Matt Peterson with Global Green, Professor Jody Freeman at Harvard Law School, and our earlier guest, Harry Shearer of Le Show on Public Radio. Good to have all of you with us. An issue, of course, we'll be taking up again and again as time goes on. When Boeing rolled out its 787 Dreamliner this weekend, it staged a global event of its own, linking partner sites in Japan and Italy, as well as Everett, Washington. The Dreamliner is the fastest-selling commercial airplane in history, even though it won't make its first flight until September. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Boeing's 787 Dreamliner is a major investment in plastic to increase size while lowering weight and requiring less fuel at a time when the airline industry is both expanding and taking heat for its impact on the environment. Stanley Holmes is Seattle correspondent for Business Week magazine, covers the Boeing company. Good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here.
Let's pick it up, if we can, where we left off with the environmental issues. Tell us in what way the 787 Dreamliner is designed to address them.
Well, in several ways. First, in terms of noise. The engines on the 787 Dreamliner are far quieter and meet all new and future noise requirements, particularly in Europe, where the issue is very, very critical to European governments and the public. That's one area. The second area is less fuel burned per seat means less carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And so the airplane will be burning less fuel. It'll be less harmful, relatively speaking, than current airplanes.
Isn't it bigger, though? Doesn't it have more people? So if you measure it in fuel per seat, is there a trade-off?
Well, there's always a trade-off, but actually this is a mid-size long-range airplane. Another one of the technological achievements is the 787-8 is seating between 220 to 250 passengers. So it's smaller than a 777, a large twin-engine wide-body, and much smaller by half than a 747 jumbo jet. So it actually in this case, would be burning less fuel.
We're talking with Stanley Holmes, Seattle correspondent for Businessweek magazine. We say that it's made of plastic. It's really a carbon fiber material. So is that different from petroleum-based plastic?
No. I mean, it's essentially the carbon fiber. It's a laminate, and it's a hardened epoxy. It's a very... it's a chemically induced process. It's not particularly environmentally friendly in the way that we'd all like to see our products made, but it's a step in the right direction. It's a huge step for an industry that, in the past was very happy to deal with a lot of toxic chemicals and aviation fuel and burn as much fuel as they can into the atmosphere. So this plane represents sort of a leap change, a leap step, if you will, in moving in clearly what is the right direction. But they still have a long way to go.
What about it in terms of the corporate future of Boeing, which not that long ago was having a lot of problems and very much falling behind the Europeans?
Well, clearly the 787 was one of those bet the company risks that Boeing and its senior executives at the commercial airplane unit, they made the bet, and they essentially hit on the right airplane at the right time because of the fuel efficiency is very appealing to airline operators because of the high fuel costs. And this airplane, Boeing believes, and so do the 47 customers, believe that the passenger comfort and what will be a much better ride for passengers will make it an airplane that passengers will demand to fly on. That remains to be seen yet, because the plane hasn't obviously entered commercial service. But I can tell you, having walked through the mock-up of the interior and someone who understands what they've done to the airplane, it could be very, very compelling.
Just have to refer back to our earlier program, which, again, is another story, but there are those who say that if we're going to deal with global warming in a serious way, we're going to have to fly less rather than more. So, again, there's a trade-off here. Obviously, Boeing wants more people in those seats, and is, from what you're saying, more people are going to be attracted there. Well, what's been the reaction of Airbus?
Well, Airbus has responded with a similar kind of airplane, but it's about 4 years about 4 years behind. It won't actually deliver the first airplane till 2013. Boeing will be delivering its first airplane in May of 2008. Like I said, Boeing got this one right. It got the right market, sort of a mid-sized market, long-range flying. This plane will fly from, let's say, San Francisco, to Beijing nonstop, carrying 220 passengers. And that's where, business travelers and people want to fly nonstop. And Airbus was more focused on a large super jumbo airplane, the A380, and sort of missed this market. and many analysts think now that is probably, you know, to some extent too late. But they will have an airplane, and only because there's only two competitors in this market, Airbus will get a certain amount of business because airlines will want them to remain in the industry and remain in this market. And in fact, the airplane they've designed is a pretty good one.
You have reported, though, that because the orders have been coming in so fast, Boeing may not be able to live up to what it's promising. There are not enough specialized bolts of the kind that hold the plane together.
Right. That hit Boeing by surprise, as well as the entire industry. Essentially, they need specialized fasteners to hold the airplane together. All planes need fasteners. And in the case of the Dreamliner, because it's composites, in critical areas they need a very specialized kind of coated fastener, mainly as a way to neutralize the lightning strikes. And as a result of all of those special demands and the industry demand, because all Airbus and Boeing production lines are all going up, there is a kind of a worldwide shortage of fasteners, and it caught everyone by surprise. But it's acutely hurting Boeing right now.
All right. Obviously, they're trying to clarify that as fast as they can or rectify that. Stanley Holmes, national correspondent in Seattle for Business Week magazine. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Today's program produced by Francis Anderton with Karen Radziner and Andrea Brody. Our technical director is Mike Newport. For more information about To the Point or to email us, kcrw.com/To the Point. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.